Hello and welcome, everybody. You are listening to our daily coverage of the 2019 Iditarod here on Mushing Radio. You can hear all of our episodes over on dogworksradio.com. And if you're here in the Matsu Valley, you can listen to us on 89.7 FM or on radiofreepalmer.org. And before we introduce our co-host tonight, I want to let some of you guys know about some cool projects that we do in the off-season. First off, we are the only continuous mushing radio show anywhere in the world, I believe. And you can hear us all year long over on dogworksradio.com. And in the last couple of years, we've released a couple of seasons that we haven't done before. And I thought that was a really cool project. Alex and I worked on the first one, which was about the 1925 Serum Run. And the second one was the Iditarod Through the Decades. And you can hear those over on our website on dogworksradio.com. And be sure you hit that subscribe button and you will get all of our episodes as soon as they drop. Without further ado, here is our co-host, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert, and it looks like we are going to have an Iditarod champion sometime overnight. My guess is that it's probably going to be about 2 or 3 in the morning, Alaska time. We have a bunch of teams in White Mountain and two teams out of White Mountain. Pete Kaiser is currently in the lead, and Yor Olsom, who is last year's Iditarod champion, is chasing after him, not too far behind. They both got 8 dogs, and Jesse Royer is currently in White Mountain and is scheduled to be able to leave at 8:40 Alaska time. Looks like the trail down from White Mountain is considerably slower than it has been in previous years. Although I think that the fact that it's that these teams are running after dark when the temperatures will go down will probably help them. We've had both a lot of snow around Nome, and especially lately, unusually high temperatures. So there's not a lot of sea ice. Reports were that there was no sea ice near Unalakleet, and some people were saying in Nome, where usually there are several miles of sea ice going out, that there was almost nothing when you're looking out in Nome. So that is what we're looking at the front of the race. And I know that we've had an awful lot of scratches since we were on the air yesterday. So it's definitely, we were relatively lucky in that there weren't very many scratches for the longest time in this race. And then we had one, and then we had a couple more. And I think yesterday there were only 4 or 5, and we're now up to 10. So wow. A lot of things have happened since we were on the air yesterday.
It has, and we're going to talk about that in just a second. But before we do, I want to tell our listeners what it is like at the finish line in Nome. And I find it really interesting because everything is a little bit different on TV, isn't it, Alex? When you see something in person, it looks a lot different than you would imagine it, doesn't it?
It really does. And there's also, in Iditarod, even though we all know, people who follow the race and people who follow mushing all know that it is an enormous achievement, almost an unthinkable achievement for most people to be able to complete an Iditarod and finish and pass under the Bald Arch. We know that there are a ton of people who are there for the winner. And then as time goes on, fewer and fewer people will actually come out to the Bald Arch as the subsequent teams come in, although almost every team will have at least, 100 or a couple of hundred people out to see them. But when the winner comes in, you can expect that there will be probably 2,000 or 2,500 people cheering them on. And Nome is not a large city. Nome is, I think, the full-time population of Nome is just a couple of thousand. But people really stream in you know, volunteers and tourists and fans really stream in to see the finish, don't they?
They do. And the setup there is it's on Front Street, which, of course, is sort of the main drag in Nome. And as they come off the trail there, they run along the city street. Typically, there's not a lot of snow there. I'm sure that there is quite a bit there this year. A lot of times they are escorted by the police department. They kind of block off traffic as the team runs in towards the finish. And then as they work their way to the finish, there is a huge mound of snow at the finish line that they bring in and kind of stack up and build this sort of a ramp there. And then right in the middle is the Burled Arch, which is, you know, the famous sign that everybody's reaching towards when they get to Nome. And it has, you know, the Iditarod race there with the mileage, and that's where the Red Lantern is and the widow's lamp and all that. But what's interesting is, and most people would expect this, but when the winner comes in, there is almost standing room only. It reminds me of something like the Super Bowl. There is very little seating or anything like that, so getting visibility of that musher is almost impossible because of all the media and all the fans and everything that's trying to work their way in. There's not a very good place to see the winner, is there, Alex?
No, unless you happen to be in that hotel, which I think is the Nome Nugget Hotel, which is right pretty much at the finish line, and there are a couple of rooms that have balconies, and you can have a nice second story view looking out over the finish line. But you're right. Aside from that, there generally will be people lined up 4, 5, 6 deep beyond the barricades, trying to get a look at what's going on as the team comes in.
Right. After they go under the arch, and this is particular for the winner, after they take a few pictures, I'm sure a lot of pictures, and then the picture of the winner and his lead dogs, and they put the roses around the dogs and all that, pretty quickly the dog team is run down the opposite end of that ramp and then over to the dog lot, which isn't too far away, and that's where the dogs stay until they're ready to fly home from Nome, and that could be as soon as the next day. It may be a few days. It may be until the banquet. Every musher does a little bit different. Have you been to the dog lot? And if you have, what's it like?
Yeah, it's really kind of remarkable. And it's about maybe 50 yards away from the finish line. It's right next to the mini convention center in Nome, which is sort of the Iditarod race headquarters in Nome. And it's just a very short trip downhill a little bit from where the Burled Arch is. And there is probably room for 50 dog teams in any typical year. And what they try to do is the winner's dogs can stay there pretty much as long as they want. And they try to get some of the other dog teams to fly out as soon as is feasible. So within often like a day or two. And as you said, it's a little bit different for everybody. Some mushers who are more local, you know, who are from the western part of Alaska, they may not fly their dogs home at all. They may mush their dogs home. They may fly their dogs to another area. But it's a pretty amazing place. And if you go a couple days after the winter comes in, you can always see at least a few mushers who are there visiting with their dogs and feeding their dogs and taking care of their dogs. And there's also a lot of volunteers who are there and helping take care of the dogs. And you have to remember that for most people, when they come in, they've been out on the trail with their dogs 24 hours a day, except for when they go into checkpoints, you know, for 10, 11, 12 days. So to go off and take a shower and leave your amazing athletes in this dog lot, a lot of mushers have reported that it feels a little bit weird, and you just sort of want to go and spend more time with your dogs because you miss them, and they're sort of like, okay, we're here now. When do we get to run again?
Right. And as you mentioned, the convention center is there pretty close to both the finish and the dog lot, and that's where the finisher's banquet is held. That is held on Sunday. It will be this Sunday. I believe it's in the evening, Alaska time. And over the past few years, they've kind of been spotty about live streaming that for the Insider subscription. Is that still the case?
Yeah, I think they are live streaming it. It used to be that you couldn't get a live stream of it at all, and they would broadcast it on a local radio station in Nome, but it was a radio station that wasn't streaming. So if you weren't actually in Nome, it was very hard to hear that. And I've always found the Finisher's Banquet to be much more interesting than the banquet in Anchorage. And part of the reason is that in Anchorage, they discourage people from making long speeches. So they will, really kind of try to get people on and off stage as soon as they can. But at the Finisher's Banquet, it's much more relaxed, and people can, and sometimes do, go on for quite a while. And at least in the past, people have been a lot more open about telling trail stories, telling about things that happened, things that inspired them. And the way it works at the banquet is they first represent all of the awards that that were given out on the trail. And so that's, the First of McGrath Award, the First of the Yukon Award, all of those awards. And then they give out a couple of awards that are voted on by the veterinarians and awards that are voted on by the other mushers. And then what they do is they go from the last place finisher, from the Red Lantern, all the way up to the winner. And each of those people is called up onto stage and is given the chance to give a speech. And sometimes with some of these mushers, it's literally 5 or 10 seconds of thanking a few people and then getting off stage. And sometimes with people who are more comfortable or who enjoy it more, they can be up there for 10 minutes. Sometimes I think I saw a speech once that was maybe 15 minutes. But it's just a lot of fun. And you get, I think, a lot more sense of who these people are as people, and you get a little bit more of an insight into their personalities.
And typically we host our show during the banquet, and we typically, Alex is typically online watching it as we're hosting our show, and he'll tell some of the stories and some of the awards that are given and that sort of thing. So definitely stay tuned, because we are on air until after that finishers banquet on Sunday evening. So please stay tuned, not just because a winner crosses sometime tonight is our coverage over. There's still a heck of a lot of racing out there and a lot of stories to be told for sure. So before we talk a little bit about our musher profile for the evening, and it's a good one, so please stay tuned to that, we want to discuss a little bit more about some of the information that came in about Nick and his scratch late last night. Is that right?
Yeah, and there's been – this is sort of – lit up the online mushing world, and there's been a lot of controversy and a lot of people expressing very strong opinions either for Nick or against Nick, and so we talk a lot about how social media is both great and horrible, and this is maybe an example of the more horrible side. But just to recap, basically, Nick had taken a relatively long run And a lot of people expected him to stop in Shaktulik, but he kept going past Shaktulik and got out onto the sea ice. There's a cabin that's about halfway between Shaktulik and the next checkpoint, which is Kayak. And actually looking at the map, maybe about a third of the way there. So that's where Nick had stopped last year, and it was expected that he was on his way there. He actually stopped a few miles short of this cabin when he was still out on the ice. He later told the insider and told some reporters that two of his dogs had gotten into a fight out there on the ice, and he had yelled at them to break up the fight, but they were not used to him yelling at them, so they basically didn't want to go anymore, even after he had broken up the fight. He then basically sat there on the ice for a very long time. Eventually he was able to get the team moving a little bit so they could go up to that shelter cabin. But then he had a pretty good lead. He had a lead of, I think, a couple of hours, and one by one, the top teams started passing him, and eventually he was passed, I think, by approximately 10 teams, and he just could not get his dogs to restart. And we've talked a lot about how when dogs don't want to go, they don't want to go, and you have to wait it out, or you have to have different strategies for how to convince them that they could go. And I think Nick had hoped that when his dogs saw other dogs running, that they would say, oh yeah, we're sled dogs, we like to run, and they would start again. That didn't happen, and he ended up going back to Shaktulik with a bunch of his dogs on several snow machines, and then scratched from the race. And there was a little bit of confusion because he was starting to head back on the snow machines, and then you can't officially scratch from the race until you talk to the race marshal. So there was some delay in doing that, and then finally that happened, and he had officially signed the papers to scratch, and the press release went out that he had scratched for the for concern about the mental health of his dogs and the mental condition of his dogs. And usually you just see these press releases will say, you know, either it's for the health of the musher or it's because of concern for the dogs. So this is a phrase I have not seen in any official press releases before. And I knew that it was going to happen, but it didn't take long before people were weighing in and, you know, either defending Nick and saying, you know, he can definitely do no wrong, or just slamming him for having run his dog so hard that they just stopped. And it's a sad thing for me because I wasn't there. I don't know exactly what happened. I have some theories about what happened. And I think the truth is most likely somewhere in the middle, like it often is. But it's last night at this time, I was thinking to myself, oh, it does not look like anyone can catch Nick, and Nick is going to be the Iditarod champion. And tonight he is out of the race, and we're looking at most likely Pete Kaiser or possibly your winning later tonight.
You know, I have the same feelings that you do. When I started reading some of those comments, just the vitriol that was taking place on a lot of those fan pages, and it's just kind of disgusting that people talk that way. And, you know, Iditarod is not much different than any other sport in regards to fandom. You know, you see that same type of comments on, you know, NFL feeds or on Twitter about baseball or soccer or horse racing or whatever. So we're definitely not immune to anything like that. But what's interesting about Iditarod compared to those other sports in particular, so many of us have been much more personally involved with a lot of those sports. Of course, you know, many boys my age or men my age now played football when we were little kids. So we kind of have an understanding of the sport, football or baseball or basketball or whatever. But now we have a group of people that feel that they can just say anything they want about a sport that they don't know anything about. And that just kind of irks me. They cast their opinions about things that they literally have no knowledge of. And that's just really disturbing to me. And maybe we'll alienate fans by saying this on this show, but I think it needs to be said that you just can't spout off and expect to have no repercussions from that. And you know, how, as you said, social media is a blessing and a curse for dog mushing. This is by far the reason why it's a curse. It's just so many people think that they're experts about a sport that they don't know anything about, and that just really upsets me. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I look back to what I knew about dog mushing 10 years ago, which was more than the average person, but very, very little compared to what I know now. But even now, I am constantly struck by the knowledge of what I don't know about the sport. The more I've learned about the sport, the more I've learned that there is a ton that I just don't know. And, you know, I think that's why I'm often reluctant to be hypercritical of mushers, because I don't know exactly what is going on the trail. It's thousands of miles away from me most of the time. It's hundreds of miles away from a lot of times from any kind of media. And we really don't know. We have like a little tiny view into this world and into the race, but we don't know what's going on out there. And you know, for that reason, I'm very reluctant to ever slam people in some of the ways that I've seen Nick slammed today. And but on the other hand, I also am very wary of people who so romanticize the sport and so worship mushers that they're unable to have any sort of to bring any sort of critical thinking into it. It definitely looks like he was running his dogs really, really hard, because he said at the beginning that it was his goal to win this race, and that was what he needed to do this year. And he had, you know, he felt like he should have won the race last year, and really wanted to, you know, to prove himself this year. I don't know for certain that that's the case, but it seems like that at least is part of what contributed to this.
Right.
But again, I wasn't there, and I recognize that there's just a lot of stuff that I don't understand, or I don't understand completely. So I'm always willing to give people and to give teams the benefit of the doubt, just because I'm not there. And, you know, and even if I were, you know, I think that if I were ever to qualify for Iditarod and be able to run Iditarod, I'm positive I would be like the last person. I'm pretty sure that I would be eliminated, or I'd have to scratch. I recognize that what these people are doing, especially the teams that are the really competitive teams and the teams that have a chance to win, is stuff that I could only dream of doing. And I think it's important for us as fans of the race and as observers of the race, especially for those of us who aren't mushers, to take that into account.
I totally agree with you. And just from that mushers perspective, I think that you're on the right track there. And again, I have not ran Iditarod, but I've been on the trail for a heck of a long time. This is my 24th year as a dog musher, so I think I've learned a thing or two out there that hopefully can combine with your fans' perspective to give that commentary that we give. You know, I hold my hat on a comment that was made to us during the early days of this year's coverage. One of our fans said that we produce some of the most fair and balanced commentary of the race. And that's a really good comment when we're covering a race like this, because there's so much one side or the other, isn't there?
There really is. And it's sometimes hard to get past your own prejudices. And I notice on social media a lot that people who are fans of one particular musher or who dislike another particular musher, you can see that colors a lot of how they approach the race. And I think for most people, we're just fans of the race. We're fans of all of the people in the race, and we want everyone to do well, and we want all of the dogs to do well. So it's sometimes when there's so much blame and vitriol, it's very discouraging for me.
So let's turn the corner a little bit. I know that you have been following the Ugly Dogs group over on Twitter in particular pretty closely. Can we get some positivity on this show today? What is going on in the Ugly Dogs world?
So it looks like Blair Braverman, who is the I don't want to say leader of the Ugly Dogs, because she's not, but the people who identify with hashtag Ugly Dogs are primarily fans of Blair's or people who were brought into the race by Blair, and she is currently on that long portage between Caltag and Uniliqlet. She is, last I checked, she was about 38th, 39th place, something like that. She seems to be doing very well. She's going, I'm looking at the tracker right now, and she's going 6.4 miles per hour, which is a good speed. You know, it's not a speed that's going to get you in the top 20, but it's definitely a speed that's going to get you there. And then at the tail end of the race, at the very back of the race, there are three mushers who've been traveling together for almost the entire race now. Cindy Galley, Jeremy Keller, and Victoria Hardwick, they are all traveling pretty much in a clump within a couple of miles, and they kind of trade off which one is ahead going down the road. Going down the trail, but they are continuing to do very well. And the fact that they're traveling together and that there's not one of them who's significantly lagging behind seems to me to indicate that they will be allowed to continue and won't be deemed uncompetitive and taken off. I know also we talked a little bit yesterday about how the Ugly Dogs had this spreadsheet, and one of the things that they were doing is to try to make sure that all of the mushers, when they get into Uniliqlet, are taken care of, and they've been coordinating ordering pizza from Peace on Earth Pizza that we talked about yesterday to be delivered to the various mushers as they come in. As we said, you know, several times, during our coverage, they really have brought just a wave of incredible positivity and energy into this race, and I think that that's going to be something that will really pay off in a big way down the line, and in terms of getting more people interested in the race and kind of turning around some of the bad press that the race has gotten in the past year or two.
Update on the story that we talked about last night about the musher that severed his finger there pretty much in the middle of nowhere, who ended up having to fly back to, from there he had to fly to Fairbanks, and Fairbanks down to, I guess it's New Orleans in Louisiana, and he reported on Twitter that all is good. He had surgery on that hand, and they reattached the tendons and ligaments, and he's ready to go, and I guess ready to to start therapy and get back to doing what he does as a pianist there, kind of a world famous pianist. Is that right?
Yeah. And it's kind of amazing because even when he was going through all of this, he was saying, don't worry about me, give all of your energy to Blair, which is an amazing thing to say for someone who had been hurt like that, who had been injured like
right.
that. So right. I think that's just a wonderful thing.
It is for sure. Alex, I know we're over time here. Do you have
Yeah, just a couple real quick stories. It looked like last night Mitch Seavey was having trouble finding his way to Koyuk. He was apparently on the ice going around in circles for quite a while, wound up heading back to Shaktulik, and then went back out on the ice when he was better, when he and his team were better able to orient themselves and figure out where they were going. And it looks like that pretty much has taken him out of contention, and you know, he will most likely still have a top 10 finish, but it looked like he was on the verge where he could have challenged and had a top 5 finish, or if things had gone the right way, might have even been in contention to win the race. So it looks like that is not going to happen. Briefly review the other scratches that we had. Ryan Reddington scratched in Shaktulik. He had 9 dogs. Brett Brueggemann also scratched in Shaktulik with 11 dogs. Lev Schwartz, I'm not sure if we mentioned that yesterday or not, scratched in Unalakleet. He had 7 dogs. He said that they were doing well, but he worried that he didn't have enough dog power going up the coast. Nicholas Wickstrom, who we talked about a few days ago, scratched in Caltag with 13 dogs. So quite a lot going on in terms of the scratches in the past 24 hours.
Yeah, that is true. And we still have a lot of race to go with those folks towards the back of the pack. So we'll see how it shakes out, and we wish them the best as they move forward towards that Burled Arch in Nome. It's a special achievement, no matter where you're at, whether you're first or last. And we hope to tell the stories as we go forward, which is what we're going to do now. We're going to talk about a musher that lives right here in our neighborhood, on our trail system here in Willow. His name is Matthew Failer, and he runs a kennel that he calls the 17th Dog. And that's pretty interesting, isn't it, Alex? I know you're probably going to mention this, but he also pulled number 17 as his bib number, and he said that was pretty ironic to pull 17 and that being his kennel name. I thought that was real cool. What do you have about Matthew Failer tonight?
So Matthew Failer is 36. He grew up in Ohio, was very active in terms of outdoor activities in states like fishing, canoeing, backpacking, camping. He was an Eagle Scout. And as you mentioned, he has a kennel called 17th Dog Kennels, which was named because up until this year, the Iditarod had 16 dogs, so he would be considered the 17th dog, or his other dogs would be considered the 17th dog. He has somewhere around 50, maybe 55 dogs. Started his kennel in 2013. He went to Ohio State University and graduated in 2007 with a BA in Fine Arts Photography. He'd been working during the summers as a guide doing dog tours on the Mendenhall Glacier in Juneau. And then after college, he moved to Alaska in 2008 and started working with musher Matt Hayadasha and a couple of other mushers in the next few years. He got a job working as a handler for Martin Boozer in 2010, and he said that one day while he was scooping poop in the dog yard, Martin asked him if he would be interested in running Martin's puppy team in Iditarod, and he said absolutely, and then spent a little bit of time completing his qualifiers, and he ran Martin's puppy team as an Iditarod rookie in 2012, finished in 47th place. He also ran the Yukon Quest in 2013, and he's completed a bunch of other mid-distance and long-distance races, including the Kusakwim 300, which he won this year. He's run Iditarod every year since 2012 and finished each time. He was 15th place in 2014 and 13th place last year when he won the Most Improved Musher, moving up from 59th in 2017 to 13th in 2018. He recently moved to winning a relatively young dog team, mostly three-year-olds, and his team includes Premier and Heisman, who are brothers who come from a line that is half Martin Boozer dogs and half Pete Kaiser dogs. They were his main leaders in the Cusco race. He also has on his team this year Iron Maiden, Pantera, Espy, and Superfly, who finished the Yukon Quest last year with a team run by one of Matt's handlers. And Rebel is another team who came from a Martin Boozer bloodline. And Matthew said that Rebel was a happy accident 7 years ago. According to he told the Toledo Blade after the just before Iditarod, we won that Kusakwim race and set a record doing it. So that was a big moment to celebrate. But shortly after, I've got a shovel in my hand and I'm scooping up poop. And you might get some publicity and some endorsements by winning, but no matter where you finish, life's still the same. And he said about training that it's all about trying to be positive. And it seems like these races are a big deal. It seems like they're dangerous. It seems like it's really cold. But if you have the right mindset, the dogs feed off your positive energy, and what seems really difficult becomes no big deal to them. Martin Boozer, whom he handled for, said of Matt Taylor, when you are in a sort of teaching or mentorship role, it's always fun when you see people who take it seriously and then do good on their own. And Matthew is definitely one of those. He pretty much emulates whatever it is that we teach, and that's really a lot more than just how to run a race. It's the lifestyle, it's the responsibility to be with your co-beings, the dogs, and the Iditarod is just the annual exam for whether you've done right by the dogs, and we love to follow Matt Failer's progress. Every year, the Iditarod hosts an educators conference right before the week before the start, and they have teachers who come up from all over the United States. And this year, Matthew Failer hosted a kennel visit at his kennel, and the teachers came up there, I think, on a bus, and they were allowed to come and meet his dog, see some of his training regimen, and get all of their questions answered about Iditarod and the mushing lifestyle. He has a second team that is running Iditarod with his handler, Michael Baker. He's currently in 19th place. Last time I checked, he was resting at that shelter cabin off the ice on his way to Koyuk. Michael Baker, who's running his puppy team, is currently in 37th place, resting in Caltag. And Matt Failer is one of these guys where every time you see him interviewed, he is very happy. He's got a lot of really amazing positive energy, and I think he's a really good ambassador towards the sport. And he's very serious about racing, and he does want to win the Iditarod some year. But in addition to that, he is just someone who is devoted to the idea of the lifestyle and to working with dogs and to letting people know what an amazing experience it can be to work with these dogs.
I couldn't have said it better, Alex. I think you mentioned everything that I was going to follow up on. So, he's a heck of a good ambassador for our sport. And as I said, he's a neighbor of ours. He lives in on the trail system here in Willow, and we frequently will see him out training his dog teams, and we'll pass each other on the trails and whatnot. He always has a very well-behaved dog team and is always very pleasant to any musher that is out on the trail. And I say that because often I am taking out students from the local university who don't have any idea about dog mushing. And when they get out there on the trails and they encounter other mushers, it could turn out like a very easy afternoon or a very difficult one, depending on who it is you're passing. So he is always one that is very patient with the new guys or gals out there on the trails for sure. So yeah, what a nice guy. I wish him the best. We're going to put a link over to his website and his show on our show page, and that way people can find more about him, because he's one of those folks that is definitely a top tier musher, but we don't hear a lot about him, and that's why I wanted to make sure we cover him on one of the shows this year. Alex, we're just about out of time. Anything else before we go?
I just wanted to mention one more thing about Matthew Failor, which is that he really seems to have taken from Martin Boozer this idea that it's important to be a great competitor, but it's even more important to be able to teach people and spread the good word about mushing and help bring people into the sport. And that is really inspiring to see from someone who is a relatively young guy and relatively new to mushing.
Of course. So Alex, when we're on air tomorrow, we will have an Iditarod champion, and I'm going to do what I usually do with you. I'm going to ask if you have a winner. Who do you think it's going to be that's coming under that Burled Arch there sometime tonight?
You know, I would love for Jessie Royer to win, but I just think she's going to run out of trail. She's not going to be able to make up the time. She's about 4 hours behind, 4.5 hours behind. So I would say that it looks very much like Pete Kaiser is going to be your new Iditarod champion, probably around 2:30 in the morning Alaska time.
Well, we'll see. I'm also thinking that it will be Pete Kaiser. It would be a heck of a good race if he and Yor do one of those things like they did back in the 70s there with Rick Mackey and tell me the story one more time. I'm forgetting it here at the end of the show.
Yeah, so it was Rick Mackey had a photo finish in 1978 where he beat I've forgotten because my brain is turning to mush. I apologize, sorry, what did you say?
Rick Swenson,
right. His dogs crossed the finish line. His lead dog crossed the finish line first, and then he collapsed into the crowd. Rick Swenson's dogs crossed about a second later, his lead dog, and then he crossed under the Burled Arch before Dick Mackey. And it wasn't clear who had actually won, and people were debating, is it the dog that finishes first, or is it the guy on the sled who has to come under the Burled Arch? And it was ruled that it's, as in horse racing, it's when the nose of the dog passes that the race is won.
Excellent. Well, maybe we'll see one of those photo finishes, and I apologize for us running out of steam there at the end and forgetting. So with that, Alex, I will talk to you tomorrow, and we'll talk about the Iditarod champion and much more here on our 2019 Iditarod coverage. Take care, and we'll talk again soon, okay?
Okay, thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto for Mushing Radio. We'll see you guys then. Goodbye.